We fight for what's right. We pray to manifest our dreams from the sleepless nights. This is our life. This is our light. Our land intertwines with our mind. It's our sacred.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. This month, our meeting of the KABU Board of Directors will be on Monday, October 29th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Cider Riot at 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Art-a-thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Art-a-thon with Impact is a 12-hour creativity and wellness festival. Young people are invited to participate in groups. In 8 hours, each group will create an original artwork that is connected to themes of mental health and wellness. A festival from 6 until 9 showcases all performances and artwork open for all to attend. Again, that's the Art-a-thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information may be found at KABU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Good morning, this is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, I was just trying to get the latest on the pseudo-explosive devices. The information is coming out. That they are fake, that they're not real explosive devices. They are just intended to terrorize. And having a little bit of a problem with my, well, computerized services, things that you really take for granted. And so I will be trying to get up to speed here. I have some topics that I want to bring up today, and one of the principal ones is the attempt to erase transgenderism. If there is an ism, it's an attempt to erase transgender people. And I think I don't like being in the position of once more coming onto the mic and trying to justify my existence, but I have to acknowledge the fact that my existence and the existence of transgender persons is under attack. And when I say the existence, I mean there is an attempt from the Trump administration to define as out of existence so that services can be restricted, so that their rabid base can be thrown the red meat of aggressing against a hated minority. And that's part of their modus operandi. It's part of their racism, chauvinism. It's all of a piece, and we can see it now as Trump gets out and says that he is a nationalist. His brand is whiteness, so of course he's a white nationalist. It's exactly what he means. He's brilliant at coming up with attacks on minorities and in throwing dog whistles to his base. It's one of the few things that he really does well. So that's what it's really about. But as I was saying, this is Press Watch. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And I have, first I want to go to some headlines in the news you're not supposed to know. From WSWS.org, the Pentagon reports to U.S. preparations for total war. It's an article by Andre Damon. He writes, over the past 2 weeks, with next to no media coverage, the United States has moved substantially closer to open military confrontation with both Russia and China, the second and third ranked nuclear powers in the world. On October 3rd, the United States threatened for the first time since the Cold War to directly attack the Russian homeland. U.S. Ambassador to NATO K. Bailey Hutchinson accused the country of violating the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty by developing a nuclear cruise missile, and said that Washington was preparing to take out the weapon with a U.S. strike. Now I want to depart from that article and talk about that cruise missile in case you've forgotten about it. It's not just a nuclear-tipped cruise missile. It is a nuclear-powered cruise missile, and it goes at many times the speed of sound. As such, it is practically unstoppable and can blast across the globe in no time and take all kinds of evasive maneuvers. And, well, it's a new kind of weapon. Its power, the fission rocket device, is something that's very much going to be in your life in the next decade. But that's a slightly different issue, so I'll return to the article, which says this statement came just three days after a Chinese warship set a collision course with a U.S. destroyer carrying out a so-called freedom of navigation operation in the South China Sea, forcing the American ship to maneuver to avoid a collision and the potentially deadliest military clash in the Pacific in decades. Behind such hair-raising incidents, the United States is undertaking serious long-term preparations to restructure the American economy to fight a major war with a peer adversary, that's in scare quotes, peer adversary, entailing radical changes to American economic, social, and political life. This is the essential content of a 146-page document released by the Pentagon last Friday, titled Assessing and Strengthening the Manufacturing and Defense Industrial Base and Supply Chain Resiliency of the United States. It makes clear that Washington is preparing not just for isolated regional clashes, but rather for a massive long-term war effort against Russia and China under conditions of potential national autarky. Autarky meaning rule by a single person. There's much more to the article. It is on WSWS.org. I want to repeat that we are under conditions in which WSWS.org and left sources generally can be electronically downvoted. They never appear on the Google News roll, for example. I use Google News a great deal. It's very handy, but I'm aware of their proclivities, one of the principal aspects of which is downvoting left sources. Now, I don't read WSWS.org uncritically. They are Trotskyist. I'm not particularly a Trotskyist. They do things like they refer to the Me Too movement as a witch hunt, which just kind of reveals what a sausage fest they've gotten to be. Hey, guys, get up to speed on that, huh? So, and then speaking of sources that one reads critically, here's another news item. This one's from Radio Havana, Cuba. Former Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa says his country's government will extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's taken shelter in the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK, to the United States, despite its legal obligation to protect the Australian national, who has also obtained Ecuadorian citizenship. Korea told Russian English language news channel RT that he believed the government of President Lenin Moreno was going to turn over Assange to the U.S. government. Julian Assange, who fears extradition to the U.S. over his leak of classified data on the website WikiLeaks, sought refuge at the Ecuadorian mission in London in 2012. Now, I want to speak for myself here and remind you that there were several things, but I think the thing that really got the U.S. government to targeting Assange and WikiLeaks was the revelation, the famous story, which I think you will probably recall, the videotape from the perspective of a helicopter pilot massacring journalists and unarmed people, kids, in a van and being quite gleeful about it in Iraq years ago. Returning to the article, at the time, Swedish prosecutors issued a European arrest warrant against him over allegations of rape and sexual assault, filed by two women in Sweden in 2010. Oh, and I want to interrupt myself again. That's also, it's by, I think I've made a mistake, excuse me. That was Chelsea Manning's crime, revealing that. But WikiLeaks has revealed, I can't remember if they revealed that specifically, but they have revealed a great deal about the Obama administration. And so this this aggression against Assange has been going on for a long time. Returning to the article, although Sweden has dropped its original arrest warrant for Assange, he faces arrest by British authorities for allegedly breaching bail conditions if he leaves the embassy. All of that, he believes, is meant to ultimately hand him over to the United States, where he is wanted for the leak of the classified information. I believe that this story from Radio Havana, Cuba, goes hand in hand with Trump's current attacks on the press. Trump has been talking about the pseudo pipe bombs, and he had a pious statement against violence, and then used the code word incivility. But then when he was at a rally, he said that the fake news, meaning anything that criticizes him, really has to dial it back because the fake news is to blame, he believes, or says, for this national terror incident of the mailing of the fake bombs to news organizations, including CNN. So that's going on, and I, if I have time today, I want to present a story that was is initially suppressed, and then it was, I want to say suppressed, but it was vilified to the point that major news organizations participated in a CIA attack on the author, and you probably guessed who I'm talking about already. It's Gary Webb, and I have a copy of a book which was published years ago. It's called Into the Buzzsaw, and actually it contains an article by Gary Webb about his reporting on the Contra cocaine connection and the use of Contra cocaine to introduce a drug horror into Los Angeles and around the nation. It was published in 2002 by Prometheus Books. It's edited by Christina Borgeson. And I'm going to put it aside for now because the first thing I want to talk about is the existence of transgender persons. It's not surprising to see that Trump's attack on transgender persons has been amplified by the National Review. The National Review will appear on your Google News roll as if it were news, but it's not news. It's reactionary opinion, always has been. It's founded by William F. Buckley. If you look back in the 1960s, I think 1964, you can find William F. Buckley inveighing in the pages of National Review that black persons should be required to show a high school diploma before being allowed to vote. That's where he was at, and that's, you know, that's where National Review is at. So the National Review has an article saying 1,000 parents of trans-identifying children beg doctors to listen. There have been many forces coming to play against transgender people in the last year particularly. I've been trying to bring that information to this forum. It comes from many sources. The bigots say, I am a Frankenstein. I am a transgender woman. I've finally, at an advanced age, managed to get gender surgery. The bigots say I'm a Frankenstein. So catch a jolt from my electrode. I'm going to read this article by National Review, line by line, and explain, because they're good at what they do, because it uses the demagoguery against transgender people. I'm going to read this line by line and criticize it. It's by Madeline Kearns. It says, 1,000 parents of trans-identifying children beg doctors to listen. It says, in child health care, the bond of trust between parents and doctors is critical, but when it comes to the treatment of youth with gender dysphoria, that bond is under a new threat. As part of an investigative series, Madeline writes, I've been in touch with an overwhelming number of parents of trans-identifying youth who feel their voices are being shut out by activists. And they make it clear, she makes it clear, that by activists, she's actually referring to the scientific community, the medical community. She writes, on one online group with membership over 1,000 parents has written a moving letter to the American Academy of Pediatrics about their recent one-size-fits-all trans-affirming policy statement. They beg for consideration. They beg for critical thinking. They beg for their children. Here's their response. Dear American Academy of Pediatrics, we need you, and our children need you. There is a great and growing disservice that needs your attention, scientific curiosity, critical thinking, clinical experience, and compassion. They write, we have serious concerns about the American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP's policy statement, ensuring comprehensive care and support for transgender and gender diverse children and adolescents. While we believe that AAP's intention behind this position statement is to protect the health of today's gender diverse youth, children through young adults, we are deeply concerned that the clinicians using affirmation therapy are inadvertently inflicting physical and psychological harm. Skipping ahead. It is our concern that the AAP's policy statement will continue and possibly worsen the harm brought to many children by the recent radical changes to treatment guidelines for transgender-identifying youth. Over the past decade, there has been an exponential rise of predominantly adolescent girls who are suddenly declaring themselves trans after the onset of puberty and who have no previous history of gender dysphoria. They write, historically, gender dysphoria showed at a much earlier age and has been exceedingly more common in boys. A recent groundbreaking study of an emergent late-onset, predominantly female trans-identifying patient population finds significant parallels with the phenomenon of eating disorders and includes social contagion as a key factor. The drastic increase in trans-identification and the switch to the predominant adolescent girl patient has prompted the United Kingdom government to launch an investigation over the concern that the 4,400% increase in the last decade could be due to a social phenomenon. So this is pseudoscience, and this is written by someone who has not read the science or chooses to ignore it. First, there has been a rise. There has been quite an increase, but I think in a scientific examination, of course, I'm not a scientist and can only speak to my analysis of scientific facts as a journalist. When they say that historically gender dysphoria showed at a much earlier age and has been exceedingly more common in boys, I think that reflects the fact that boys generally, due to our gender hierarchy, have felt more open in expressing their true feelings. Not much, I would say, as a transgender male to female myself, there isn't a hell of a lot of opening, but it is surely easier for a boy to say what he thinks or feels than it is for a girl to say what she thinks or what she feels. A recent groundbreaking study, they say, the sentence that I just read finds significant parallels with the phenomenon of eating disorders and includes social contagion. Well, If there is a parallel with eating disorders, then it probably reflects that same paradigm, the fact that women generally, girls, find it upsetting when they see how strictly their gender role is going to confine them. And that is surely greater for a female-bodied person who is actually male. The drastic increase in trans identification has switched to a UK investigation. Well, I think that the investigation will have to look at all of those factors. They write, there is great harm being done to girls and some boys by medicalizing their gender nonconforming behavior based on gender stereotypes, homosexuality, and or underlying mental health issues that have led to trans identification. The medicalization with gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists is highly experimental and comes with serious long-term consequences for bone health, particularly for neurological health, and sterilizes the child when followed by cross-sex hormones. This sentence really gets to the core of the thousand parents problem. The fact is, the pain of watching the transformation, the pain of experiencing transgenderism for parents has been identified as similar to that of the death of a child. And that is true even in later age. I didn't transition until my 40s. My parents suffered that kind of pain. And these parents are suffering that kind of pain, and they want to find a way out of it. They want to find a way to deny it, and they're doing it with pseudoscience. The fact is, they say that there's harm being done by medicalizing their gender nonconforming behavior based on gender stereotypes, homosexuality, and underlying mental health issues. Well, they simply do not have the tools to address that. They obviously haven't done the reading and don't understand the Harry Benjamin standards of care, for example, not used strictly, but something that underlines current mental health understanding of transgenderism. And they are very concerned that they are going to lose their daughters, and they are going to lose their daughters because, attention, thousand parents of trans-identifying children, your daughters are boys. I know that hurts. But denying it is going to hurt worse. They write, astonishingly, cross-sex hormones are given to the opposite sex in trans-identifying adolescents who are expected to be treated for their full lives and have permanent effects. The harms of surgeries are self-evident and irreversible, which is problematic for youth who change their minds. And they go skipping forward into the article, which, as I said, is in the reactionary National Review. They make the very common error, the near constant error of referring to a certain Swedish study as proof that that transgender surgery causes negative outcomes, that it causes an increase in suicide, and this is this is absolutely incorrect. It is a complete misreading of the study. And I hope that you'll pardon me for stumbling a bit with this. I had a little difficulty getting the computer to print up my script today, just at the last moment. So I'm trying to get to the information that I had put together for this show. I'd like to ask you to call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. There is a rebuttal of the usage of the Swedish study for conclusions that are opposite of what it actually finds. It's on transadvocate.org, and I had hoped to bring that to you, but it has not printed up, and so I don't think that I'll try to search it out as I'm on the air. Time is 9:23. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm talking about the attack on the existence of transgender persons. I have an article by Marie Brie that was printed on The Verge. Its title is, Trump's Gender Policy is Both Cruel and Scientifically Bankrupt. She writes, The Trump administration's newly proposed interpretation of Title IX, which had effectively cut transgender people out of existence in federal policy, is a fundamental perversion of science, medicine, and culture. Despite the language used in the memo, it is neither grounded in science nor objective. It is an ideologically extreme position that isn't supported by biology or gender theory. Despite the president's insistence that such a policy is needed to protect America, it is little more than an unjustifiable effort to inflict further suffering on the transgender community. And speaking for myself, when it comes to the attacks on Title IX, the attacks on transgender persons coming from the Trump administration, they're even less sophisticated than the pseudoscience from the letter that I just read from National Review. They instead want to reify the popular misconception that gender, as well as sex, is defined by XX or XY chromosomes. This is incorrect. It's a perfect example of the idea that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. There is a whole science of epigenetics, and of course, as I'll read in a moment here, there XX and XY is simply it's kindergarten level understanding of chromosomes. And so number to call 503-231-8187. I'll go to the first caller. Hi, Sabrina, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm trans. I'm 60 years old. Founder of Southern Comfort Comforts in Atlanta in the 90s. I have an alternate thought on when you said it's easier for boys. I don't think it's necessarily easier for boys. I was a late revealer coming out or being aware in when I was going through puberty and when I was about 3, like so many other trans folks identify when they're very early in age. But I don't think it's easier for boys. I think for boys, for girls, I should say, I think there was a lot more options, especially back in the day, where they could be, quote-unquote, tomboys, and, you know, at least experiment with their male side a little easier than a boy could experiment with their girl side.
Well, that is surely removed during puberty.
Yeah, I did not come out for a very, very long time. I was experimenting in my teens and obviously came out to myself and admitted I was trans at an earlier age, but I did not find it very easy to do, nor was it easier for me to come out than I would say people who I see right now who are F2Ms and coming out. I know many F2Ms. I actually have one who works for me. I think the difficulties had to do with other issues than that it was easier for a boy. I don't think it was, I disagree with you on that. I don't think it was very easier for a boy to come out as a girl, especially when you understand that you're moving into a quote-unquote lower hierarchy, the word used was hierarchy. You do become, you lose your male privilege, as we both know. And anyway, just want to thank you for letting me comment on that. I think you're doing a great job with this show right now and bringing this topic out. I'm very worried about what's happening in this country and us moving backwards. So, thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your call. And, yeah, I'm worried about the backlash, and my examination of backlashes generally indicate to me that they occur with surprising speed and force. This attempt by the Trump administration to solidify its base has greater consequences. But for a sociopath like Trump, well, that's no big deal. He doesn't care because he can't. Number to call 503-231-8187. Returning to the article I was reading, the memo calls on the Departments of Justice, Health and Human Services, Education and Labor to adopt a unified interpretation of the meaning of the word sex to mean the sex listed on a person's birth certificate as originally issued shall constitute definitive proof of a person's sex unless rebutted by reliable genetic evidence, according to the New York Times, which broke the story on Sunday. Roger Severino, the controversial head of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights, is responsible for the move. Severino has a history of hostility towards the LGBTQ community. He has argued that protecting trans people represents a radical gender ideology, and he virulently opposed recognition of same-sex marriage. Since joining DHHS, Severino has pressed for a rule that would allow healthcare professionals to refuse to treat transgender patients on religious grounds. So, again, speaking for myself, if it wasn't clear from the source, then a closer examination will show that this is simply an ideologically based, hate-based attack. Marie Brie writes, as I said in TheVerge.com, it's unclear how widely the rule will be applied outside Severino's office, but if it were applied across the executive branch, this change in interpretation could be devastating to the transgender community. Hundreds of thousands of trans people who have obtained a passport with a gender marker that matches their gender presentation under new Obama-era rules could see their documents revoked. Students at the K-12 and college level could lose any legal backing to press for access to gender-appropriate bathrooms and locker rooms and for equitable treatment by educators and administrators. Federal transgender employees could be forced to detransition or lose their jobs over their gender presentation. Transgender workers could be barred from bringing cases to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for discrimination based on their identity or presentation. The policy could make it difficult for trans people on Medicare or Medicaid to access appropriate health care, and it could be used by insurers, hospitals, and healthcare professionals to deny important and needed care to trans people. In short, this effort represents nothing less than an out-and-out assault on the ability of the transgender community to participate in public life. Now, I'll return to that article in a moment. I am inviting your calls, 503-231-8187. But first, I want to talk about transgenderism in a more general sense, because the demagogues depend on poorly considered or unconsidered opinions. And one of those is the idea that transgenderism has suddenly erupted. It may appear so, but this is a phenomenon of recognizing transgender people's existence. Suddenly you can see transgender people. It seems like there's far more than you would have guessed. And if you're frightened of them, there may seem to be a great number of us. But we've always been around. And in fact, in this town, there is a golden statue of a transgender man. And it's a very famous statue. Thousands of people pass it every day. And so I want to read a little bit from a book that I recommend. It's difficult to get. It's very precious to me. It's called Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture by Arthur Evans, and it was published more than 40 years ago. On May 30th, 1431, in the town of Rouen, France, a peasant woman named Joan of Arc, age 19, was burned alive at the stake as a relapsed heretic. The immediate reason for her death was that she was found wearing men's clothing in her prison cell. The fact about Joan's execution may surprise those who view her as a traditional Christian saint, but the records of the time show she was hardly traditional. After 1425, when she started her drive against the English invaders of France, Joan of Arc was an adamant transvestite. On May 23, 1430, she was captured by a sellout French faction. They sold her to the English, who charged her with heresy and handed her over to the Inquisition. At the trial, Joan's judges were horrified by her transvestism. Articles, and this, as I said, is decades old and uses old terms and blurs terms a little bit. They're talking about her transgenderism, but they write, Article 12 of her indictment read, Joan, rejecting and abandoning women's clothing, her hair cut about like a young coxcomb, took shirt, breeches, and doublet, tight-fitting boots or buskins, long spurs, sword, dagger, breastplate, lance, and other arms in the fashion of a man of war. When brought before the court, Joan refused to promise to wear women's clothing, even though her refusal meant she couldn't receive communion. What's more, she insisted that her transvestism was a religious duty, saying, for nothing in the world, well, I swear not to arm myself and put on a man's dress. I must obey the orders of our Lord, end quote. To the judges, it was bad enough that Joan had been wearing men's clothing, but to say it was a religious duty was heresy. The following was one of the chief charges brought against her. Joan d'Arc, Joan of Arc, attributes to God, his angels, and his saints' orders, which are against the modesty of the sex, and which are prohibited by divine law, things abominable to God and man, interdicted on pain of anathema by the ecclesiastical censure, such as dressing herself in the garments of a man, short, tight, dissolute, those underneath as well as above, to attribute all this to the order of God, to the order which has been transmitted to her by the angels and even by virgin saints, is to blaspheme God and his saints, to destroy the divine law, and to violate the canonical rules, end quote. So, speaking for myself, as I've often said, transgender people are the bomb. Returning to the text, as I was saying, Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture by Arthur Evans, the English drew attention to Joan's transvestism and urged the church to condemn her for that reason. The King of England, Henry VI, even got involved on this point. In a letter he wrote about Joan, he said, "It is sufficiently notorious and well known that for some time past, a woman calling herself Jeanne de Pucelle, the maid, leaving off the dress and clothing of the feminine sex, a thing contrary to divine law and abominable before God and forbidden by all laws, wore clothing and armor such as is worn by men. The sellout French faction that had captured Jean called her homasse, which is a derogatory term in Old French, meaning masculine women," and I apologize for my poor pronunciation of French. "Not only did Joan wear men's clothing as a religious duty, but in the eyes of her judges, she did something just as bad. She acted masculine, contrary to the Christian view of womanhood. She was bold, self-assertive, strong-willed, and contemptuous of her captors. In Article 63 of the original indictment, the judges condemn her for allowing herself a tone of mockery and derision such as no woman in a state of holiness would allow. The judges were horrified that Joan had rejected the traditional woman's role. She disdains," they wrote, "also to give herself up to feminine work, conducting herself in all things rather as a man than as a woman." Excuse me, end quote. The fact that Joan had led male troops in battle and had even given them orders seemed to her judge another sign of heresy, quote, "In contempt of the orders of God and the saints, Joan, in presumption and pride, has gone so far as to take command over men." I'm reading about Joan of Arc, that very Joan of Arc in the statue over there in the roundabout on Cesar Chavez Street in Portland, Oregon, the golden statue. The judges were interested in Joan's relationship with other women. In the summer of 1424, Joan had left her parents against their will and went to live with another woman, La Russe, who lived in Neufchâteau. La Russe, it turns out, was an innkeeper, which is interesting since inns in the Middle Ages were often brothels. In Article 8, the judges accused Joan of hanging out with prostitutes, quote, "Towards her 20th year, Joan, of her own wish and without permission of her father and mother, went to Neufchâteau in Lorraine and was in service for some time at the house of a woman, an innkeeper named La Russe, the Red, where lived women of evil life, and where soldiers were accustomed to lodge in great numbers. During her stay in the inn, Jean sometimes stayed with these evil women," end quote. The judges also questioned Joan about her relationship with another woman, Catherine de la Rochelle. Joan admitted to the judges that she had slept in the same bed with Catherine on two successive nights, but that her reason for doing so was religious. Joan claimed that Catherine told her she had often had visions of a lady at night, and Joan said she wanted to see this lady too. Whatever reason, Joan admitted to sleeping twice with Catherine. The judges were interested in Joan's sex life, had her examined by a panel of women to determine if she was a virgin. They reported that she was. Joan's behavior at the trial was hardly that of a Christian saint. When she was asked to swear to tell the truth on the Gospels, she repeatedly refused. Usually after much haggling back and forth at each session, she would give in partially by swearing on the Missal, which is the liturgy. In addition, Joan adamantly refused to recite either the Lord's Prayer or the Creed, though she was asked to do so many times. Her judges thought this refusal was significant. The mystery of Joan deepens as we look at other aspects of her life before her capture. Whenever she appeared in public, she was worshipped like a deity by the patients. By the peasants, a practice she never discouraged. The peasants believed that she had the power to heal, and many would flock around her to touch part of her body or her clothing, which was men's clothing. Subsequently, her armor was kept on display at the Church of St. Denis, where it was worshipped. The area of Lorraine, where Joan grew up, was famous for the lingering paganism of its people. In the century before Joan's trial, the Synod of Treves had condemned the peasants of Lorraine for believing, quote, "in all kinds of magic, sorcery, witchcraft, auguries, superstitious writings, the illusions of women who boast that they ride at night with Diana or Herodias, and a multitude of other women," end quote. The peasants who lived in Joan's own neighborhood retained memories of prophecies from the old Celtic religion that existed there before the introduction of Christianity. So, Joan of Arc, the trans man, really upset the society. And Arthur Evans goes on to relate that whereas she was imprisoned for these various heresies and really for opposing the English, pardon me, she was finally killed for reverting to the clothing of a man. She was a he. Joan of Arc was a trans man. Now, I expect I'll get some backlash on that, similar to when I point out that Beethoven was black. But it's just the facts, and it's not going to change whether you like it or not. Sort of like the trans men who are growing up and whose existence is being resisted by pseudoscience by their parents and reported, as I was saying, in a national review. The time is 9:39. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I've been talking about the existence of transgender persons as it is being challenged by the Trump administration, and trying to point out that we, the transgender, exist, have existed, have always existed. We are important to the society for a number of reasons. Our perspective outside the gender binary gives us strength and examination of the society often, and that's just part of it. I want to return to the article I was reading before by Marie Brie. The administration's definition of sex isn't grounded in science. Even outside of transgender people, medical notions of gender rarely fit into two absolute, immutable, and mutually exclusive categories. There are lots of well-documented conditions where a person's gender diverges from what their genes or genitals would indicate. In Swire syndrome, small mutations in a gene on the Y chromosomes cause an XY individual to develop a normal vulva, vagina, and uterus, but with poorly formed gonads containing testicular tissue. Similarly, those with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome can be XY but develop a normal vulva and vagina with no uterus and undescended non-functional testicles because their bodies don't respond to testosterone at all. Conditions such as partial androgen insensitivity syndrome, 5-alpha reductase deficiency, and congenital adrenal hyperplasia can all cause infants to be born with genitals that cannot be easily classified into male or female. What's more, it is nearly impossible to determine that what these children's gender identities will be based on their genitals, based on their genitals alone. Intersex individuals have fought for years for the right to define their own genders and to change the practice of surgically altering ambiguous genitals during infancy. Though these conditions are uncommon, they aren't that rare. They occur at a rate of 1 or 2 per 1,000 births, so there are at least 325,000 intersex individuals in the United States. Newer research indicates up to 1% of the population may exhibit some form of intersexuality. Again, speaking for myself, it's an offensive circumstance that I must get up before the mic once again, as I have done much of my life, and defend my transgenderism and to defend transgender persons. In the example I was reading from Witchcraft and the Gay Counterculture, I show that there are more transgender persons in history than you are aware of, and their seeming efflorescence now, our seeming efflorescence, is simply due to the fact that you are now able to see us. And there are people who want that to go away. This is erasure. It's very serious. And as we can see from the pseudo pipe bombs attacks and the attacks of armed thugs who come into this town and come into Portland from across the river with impunity and attack people of color and gay persons, GLBTQ persons, as we can see from this phenomenon, it is very dangerous to have a demagogue as commander-in-chief. And his, unlike those of private persons, his hints, his dog whistles, his opinions, and his aggression against all of us who are not wealthy, white, male Christians has powerful effects, and he knows it, and he's using it. And we do risk now a war for the apartheid position of the ruling white males. Now, if you're a white male, I'm not against you for being a white male. I'm against your whiteness. But, I mean, I'm not against you for being yourself. And I just want to make that clear, because I know that what I'm saying will be heard by some as an attack on their existence. But But that's exactly the opposite of what's really happening. People like me have an attack on their existence. And so for now, I'll talk about that. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Under the category Using the Language and Authority of Science to Justify Old Prejudices, as a result, she writes, experts in the field continue to make a strong push for considering the whole of biological sex to be viewed as a spectrum. As writer and scientist Julie Serrano has argued, sex and gender are deeply multifaceted concepts that must take into account everything from hormonal biochemistry to neuroanatomy to genetics and more. The medical facts cannot simply be distilled down to the appearance of one's genitals or the possession of a specific set of chromosomes. In fact, the existence and validity of transgender identities is settled medical consensus, and trans people now have the support of most major professional medical organizations. The American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the Endocrine Society, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Society, and the National Association of Social Workers have all adopted policies specifically supporting the rights of trans people to live as their identified gender. And again, speaking for myself, that is because they've done the work, they know the science, they know what they're talking about. Returning to the article, the White House isn't using science for its policy. Instead, it's using the language and authority of science to justify old prejudices. In fact, the Trump administration, she writes, has made a habit of using genetics this way. Trump has repeatedly touted his belief that his own superior genes are responsible for his wealth and power. He's attacked Senator Elizabeth Warren and tried to bully her into proving her claims of indigenous ancestry through a DNA test, an idea that is both scientifically nonsensical and something Native Americans find deeply offensive. This strange focus on genes runs deep in white nationalist groups, where Trump finds significant support as well, where there is an obsession with proving one's supposed racial purity through genetics, something geneticists soundly reject. Unfortunately, she writes, the use of pseudoscience to further an agenda of hate is common throughout American scientific history. The entire field of genetics has had to work hard to dissociate itself from the now debunked race science and eugenics movements of the early 20th century, and that work isn't over. The LGBTQ community suffered for decades because bad science determined that they were inherently mentally ill, or worse yet, predators. Mentally ill and intellectually disabled people have been subjected to torture, confinement, and forced sterilization based on public fear and misunderstanding. Deeply skewed understandings of biology and obstetrics underpin efforts to restrict women's access to both abortion and contraception. Poor public and scientific understanding of HIV led to years of rampant misinformation that pushed HIV-positive individuals to the margins of society out of unfounded fear. She concludes, this newly proposed redefinition of sex is a scientifically bankrupt idea that simply furthers the administration's agenda against transgender people, and it can only be understood as a kind of cruelty. It runs counter to the well-understood realities of biological sex and places the personal opinions of a few bureaucrats above the wide consensus of medical experts. Trans people are not a new phenomenon, and their existence is not an ideology. President Trump could not be more wrong. It's not our country that must be protected from trans people, but trans people who must be protected from the naked bigotry of this administration. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, what I'm saying goes against what Trump is saying, and therefore is defined by him as fake news. Trump is very much opposed to the whole idea of journalism and would really prefer that people act around him as they always have in his personal life, which is to simply justify his every opinion because of his great wealth. It's a very undeveloped personality aspect. It's unfortunate for him personally. It's the way people treat other people with great power, in their effort to get some of that power, or maybe just to survive. Trump has often used his wealth to hire lawyers who can ruin anyone's life if they go in great numbers and with considerable funding into the courts with false allegations. He's very much known for using that power, and now he's using the office of the presidency in the same way. There are people opposed to him and to what he does, and so he's going to go after them because, as I said before, he's a sociopath, and because of his upbringing, probably, and he simply cannot understand the suffering of others. There's an article in, there's a chapter into the book that I mentioned before, Into the Buzzsaw, by Gary Webb, who was an investigative reporter for 19 years, focusing on government and private sector corruption and winning more than 30 journalism awards. He was one of six reporters at the San Jose Mercury News to win a 1990 Pulitzer Prize for general news reporting for a series of stories on Northern California's 1989 earthquake. And the book goes on to refer to various awards that he received. And this was printed after he was effectively forced out of his job after the San Jose Mercury News retracted their support for his story. And while he was a consultant to the California State Legislature's Joint Audit Committee. But it was before his miraculous post-mortem suicide actions, in which he appeared at his door, apparently to answer it, and shot himself in the head. And then, because that wasn't enough, shot himself a second time. I phrase it that way out of sarcasm, because after he was demonized and excluded from the circle of acceptable corporate journalists, pardon me, even his suicide, it wasn't his, even his murder was presented falsely. He wrote, "If we had met 5 years ago," and this is in 2002, he's writing this, "you wouldn't have found a more staunch defender of the newspaper industry than me. I'd been working at daily papers for 17 years at that point, doing no holds barred investigative reporting for the bulk of that time. As far as I could tell, the beneficial powers the press theoretically exercised in our society weren't theoretical in the least. They worked." And Gary Webb wrote, "I wrote stories that accused people and institutions of illegal and unethical activities. The papers I worked for printed them, often unflinchingly and many times gleefully. After these stories appeared, matters would improve. Crooked politicians got voted from office or were forcibly removed. Corrupt firms were exposed and fined. Sweetheart deals were rescinded. Grand juries were impaneled. Indictments came down. Grafters were bundled off to the big house. Taxpayers saved money. The public interest was served. It all happened exactly as my journalism school professors had promised, and my expectations were pretty high. I went to journalism school while Watergate was unfolding, a time when people were as distantly connected to newspapering as college professors were puffing out their chests and singing hymns to investigative reporting. Bottom line, if there ever was a true believer, I was one. My first editor mockingly called me Woodstein after the pair of Washington Post reporters who broke the Watergate story. More than once, I was accused of neglecting my daily reporting duties because I was off running around with your trench coat flapping in the breeze. But in the end," Gary Webb writes, "all the sub rosa trench coat flapping paid off. The newspaper published a 17-part series on organized crime in the American coal industry and won its first national journalism award in half a century. From then on, my editors at that and subsequent newspapers allowed me to work almost exclusively as an investigative reporter. I had a grand total of one story spike during my entire reporting career. That's it, one. And in retrospect, it wasn't a very important story either. Moreover," he writes, "I had complete freedom to pick my own shots, a freedom my editors wholeheartedly encouraged since it relieved them of the burden of coming up with story ideas. I wrote my stories the way I wanted to write them, without anyone looking over my shoulder or steering me in a certain direction. After the lawyers and editors went over them and satisfied themselves that we had enough facts to stay out of trouble, they printed them, usually on the front page of the Sunday edition when we had our widest readership. In 17 years of doing this," Gary Webb wrote, "nothing bad had happened to me. I was never fired or threatened with dismissal. If I kept looking under rocks, I didn't get any death threats that worried me. I was winning awards, getting raises, lecturing college classes, appearing on TV shows, and judging journalism contests. So how could I possibly agree with people like Noam Chomsky and Ben Bagdikian, who are claiming the system didn't work, that it was steered by powerful special interests and corporations and existed to protect the power elite? Hell, the system worked just fine as far as I could tell. It encouraged enterprise. It rewarded muckraking. And then I wrote some stories that made me realize how sadly misplaced my bliss had been. The reason I'd enjoyed such smooth sailing for so long hadn't been, as I had assumed, because I was careful and diligent and good at my job. It turned out to have nothing to do with it. The truth was, in all those years, I hadn't written anything important enough to suppress." And the murdered Gary Webb wrote, "In 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance that began this way. For the better part of a decade, a Bay Area drug ring sold tons of cocaine to the Crips and Blood street gangs of Los Angeles and funneled millions in drug profits to a Latin America guerrilla army run by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, a Mercury News investigation has found. This drug network opened the first pipeline between Colombia's cocaine cartels and the black neighborhoods of Los Angeles, a city now known as the crack capital of the world. The cocaine that flooded in helped spark a crack explosion in urban America, and provided the cash and connections needed for LA's gangs to buy automatic weapons. It is one of the most bizarre alliances in modern history, the union of a U.S.-backed army attempting to overthrow a revolutionary socialist government and the Uzi-toting gangsters of Compton and South Central Los Angeles. The three-day series was, at its heart, he writes, a short historical account of the rise and fall of a drug ring and its impact on Black Los Angeles. It attempted to explain how shadowy intelligence agencies, shady drugs, and arms dealers, a political scandal, and a long-simmering Latin American civil war had crossed paths in South Central Los Angeles, leaving behind a legacy of crack use. Most important, it challenged the widely held belief that crack use began in African American neighborhoods, not for any tangible reason, but mainly because of the kind of people who lived in them. Nobody was forcing them to smoke crack, the argument went, so they only have themselves to blame. They should just say no. Much more to that article, and have some callers. Earlier I was talking about the attempt to erase transgender persons, and was talking about the trans man, Joan of Arc. And we'll go to the first caller now. Chris is on the air.
Hi, is it Teresa?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hi, nice to meet you. And I just had a question. You know, it's not, I'm not trying to be offensive, but it's just a concept that I, you know, that's newer to me, and I can't quite wrap my head around it. You know, with all the different gender pronouns, and I guess I don't understand. Like, I've heard that there's a lot of them, like upwards of like 20 different pronouns. Is that correct, or am I reading something wrong? But you know, when you were talking earlier, you were saying something along the lines of there were old biological prejudices against, like, the different genders, so, like, defining people as only male and female.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure how that would, I guess, to me, I don't understand how that's, like, a prejudice, more just, like, an observation from the time versus now our understandings are changing. Is it, I don't know if prejudices would be the right word for describing that, but...
Well, as I was saying before, transgender persons have been violently suppressed. That's why our suicide rate is so high. That is the only reason why our suicide rate is so high. I happen to like life myself. Once the suppression is lifted, even a small amount, it is possible to see transgender persons. Once you see transgender persons, once you see intersex persons, you understand that there is a spectrum of gender, spectrum of genitalia. There is a spectrum of sex.
Well, wouldn't that be falling kind of, I guess, not trying to put everything in the same category or anything, but I mean, wouldn't that be kind of the same where you have someone who's, I mean, definitely a male, definitely a female, but then you have, you know, maybe transgenders, you know, who aren't quite fitting of exact definitions, of course, but wouldn't that fall under the same kind of, I guess, terminology or so, or wouldn't that be transgender? Or I guess I'm not sure, like, as the spectrum goes, you know, with 20 different pronouns, it just doesn't make too much sense to me, especially when you were trying to, or when you were explaining, you know, from some of the biologists that even chromosomes may not necessarily dictate the gender. Wouldn't that, not meaning to sound offensive, but I guess I'm just trying to figure out an analogy for it. But
okay, let me repeat that then. Sure. The understanding of chromosomes as XX or XY is excessively simplistic. There are many variations. I was referring to some of them earlier. Androgen insensitivity syndrome, also known as a famous actress. I was going to say her name, and I really can't think of it. Jamie Lee Curtis. She's all woman, and she is XY. This is because of the expression of the genes. There is an entire epigenetic code, which is only discovered in the past decade. So there is complexity to it. I'm not aware of any 20 pronouns in English anyway. I'm generally using he, she, they, and maybe Z on rare occasion. So I don't think it's that complex.
Okay. It is complex. Yeah, I guess however, when I was hearing there was some word like Z's and Z's. I don't know. I mean, I've heard a few others, but I just didn't know exactly how that works into the whole equation on that. But
it's okay. Easy enough, though. If you ask someone what their pronoun is, then you can just go from there. Or you can avoid pronouns altogether, which is what I generally do, because I'm a little socially phobic, and I don't always get those things straight. So I just back off a little bit when it comes to specificity. And really, who cares about the specificity if I'm really dealing with someone as a human being, and I'm dealing with who they are and what competencies they have, rather than some definition and some confinement of their gender. Thanks for calling in. Let me see if I can talk to the last person online real quickly. Hi, Per.
Hey, good morning. Good morning.
Hey, Per, got 30 seconds. What's up?
Okay, well, I just want to point out that Mike Rupert really believed that Gary Webb did kill himself.
Well, Rupert killed himself, so maybe he saw something dark in there. I find it hard to believe that he could. I knew someone who committed suicide with a .22 pistol, but those were not .22 caliber shots, and I don't see how in the world he could have shot that second bullet.
Well, I think Mike Rupert went into this, you know. He talked about it, wrote about it, but he really did believe that. He told me personally, and he's written about it in his blog, that he thinks Gary Webb was driven to suicide by, you know, the way he was treated by the media, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point, and maybe it's too fine a point. He certainly was driven they destroyed his life, and that was what I was going to read further into the Buzzsaw, the incredible extent to which the corporate media generally was bullied into turning on Gary Webb to preserve themselves, to preserve their relationship with government generally. Thanks a lot, Per, for calling in. Thank all of you for calling in, and those of you listening, you can hear this as a podcast on KBOO.FM. It's under KBOO.FM/PressWatch. We're broadcasting to you via 90.7 FM on our big transmitter on the West Hills, other frequencies in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. Coming up later this morning on KBOO at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Tommy Pico about Junk, the third book in his Teebs trilogy. At 11:30 on The Film Show, Ben Pop from the Northwest Film Center introduces us to two up-and-coming directors whose movies are screening at the 45th Annual Northwest Filmmakers Festival. But next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, and if you'd like to become one, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. KBOO programming is made possible by listener members and support from Portland Saturday Market. 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland. Featuring live music and Kids Corner events, Portland Saturday Market every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more online at Portland Saturday Market.